Eclipse files bankruptcy, taxes in the UK, China flies its own RJ, and a discussion with the CEO of the cockpit, Kevin Garrison, on episode 25 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Welcome back, everybody. This is episode 25 of the Airplane Geeks. Thanks for joining us. I'm Courtney. With me, as always, is Max.
Hi, Court. Hello, everybody.
And this week, our guest is Kevin Garrison. He is an aviation writer, a humorist, and a retired airline captain. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. Well, Max, we do have a slew of news to cover, so what do you say we jump right into it?
I'm full of turkey, and let's go.
Okay, first up, this is from Aviation Week, a news story that we've been following for quite some time. Finally, it happens. Eclipse Aviation files for bankruptcy. Albuquerque-based Eclipse Aviation announced today, this is November 25th, that it has filed for Chapter 11 protection in the U.S. Bankruptcy Court in Delaware. It simultaneously applied for a sale of its assets in accordance with Section 363 of the U.S. Bankruptcy Code to the European Technology and Investment Research Center, a firm that is Eclipse's largest shareholder with an investment estimated to be close to $140 million.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to keep up with Eclipse these days, whether it's paychecks are not coming, paychecks are coming, and now we have Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And things have been moving pretty quickly, and apparently the largest shareholder is stepping in with a plan to purchase the assets.
Piper, which I believe is the CEO, right?
Roel Piper. Yeah.
Oh, Piper.
Roel Piper.
In the face of unprecedented economic challenges, it is clear that the sale of Eclipse business through the Chapter 11 process is the right course of action to maximize the value of the business, secure its future, and protect the best interests of Eclipse stakeholders, customers, suppliers, employees, and creditors. You know, Max, I'm surprised they even highlighted that there was no substance in that whatsoever.
Well, I think this is a desperation move. This is the survival move that benefits certainly the large shareholder and the company itself, but does really nothing for the current owners of these aircraft and just about everybody else associated with it. When they declare bankruptcy in this way, and with the deal to sell the firm's assets to the other party, everyone loses. The folks that have submitted deposits in the past become unsecured debt holders, which means they stand to lose everything. Existing Eclipse owners are likely to have to pay on a time and material basis for any kind of repairs or any kinds of activity that they would have thought would be covered under their warranty. So they lose out on this as well.
There was an interesting paragraph in this article that mentions that Eclipse needs another $250 to $300 million to resume normal operations and fulfill its obligations to customers. The amount could be slashed to $150 million if Eclipse reneges on all contracts, including $60 million in refunds owed to customers who cancel their contracts, elects not to honor flight into known icing and avionics upgrades, which could save up to $50 million, and bumps the price of all aircraft to be delivered to $2.15 million or more. The one that really sticks out to me there is ignoring flight into known icing. I don't think you can operate a jet without, at some point, going into known icing conditions. There are icing conditions, at altitude, even during some of the warmer months of the year. That surprises me that they would even consider that.
But on any aircraft, those kinds of issues do get corrected, I mean, as you guys know, eventually. And the same would hold true, I think, with the Eclipse. But, this action now with bankruptcy kind of, throws all that to the wind. There are very little, requirements, especially financial requirements, that they're going to have to meet while they're under bankruptcy protection. And essentially, the the insiders, if you will, the company insiders end up taking over control of the assets and kind of get to start fresh. There's some good information about this on the Eclipse Aviation Critic NG blog. We all know that as being a good source of information of all things Eclipse, and they've reproduced the letter, the internal email from Mike McConnell, who's one of the Eclipse presidents, to the employees, describing what the impact is of this Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And it's it's pretty ugly. I mean, basically they intend to keep the company operating until the assets are purchased, and they hope to do that sometime in January. But you're not going to see much in the way of production. You're not going to see much in the way of customer support in that interim period. And then I guess we get to see what happens in January with a fresh sheet of paper, as far as how Eclipse is going to meet its, the expectations of its customers.
Okay, moving into our next story, this from Air Cargo World Online. Airlines balk at UK tax. The U.S. Air Transportation Association says the UK government's plan to increase its air passenger duty on airlines flying to and from Britain on November 1st, 2009 is illegal. To give you an idea, the new duty on a one-way economy class flight from the United States to the UK will now cost $90, up from $60. So that's a 50% increase just in taxes to fly from the US to London.
It's a big jump. The claim is that this is, an environmental tax, or a tax based on the miles flown of the aircraft, and relating that to carbon footprint, but the counter to this is that the money collected from this source is not used for any environmental issues. It just sort of goes towards the general fund, and that's the issue that people have with this, whether or not the UK can impose this kind of a tax on other on the airlines of other countries that don't originate within the UK. And use the money to fund their government.
In a related article in this, I'm going to bring up as well, this from telegraph.co.uk, the critics line up to attack APD. In a major rethink on Monday, the government abandoned its plans to impose a levy on aircraft, aiming at taxing the most polluting planes in favor of a revamped APD. Max, help me out. APD stands for...
Air Passenger Duty.
Duty. There you go.
Right, yep.
By 2010 to 11, a family of four flying economy class to Australia will pay £340 APD, more than double today's £160, potentially making it cheaper to catch the Eurostar to Paris and fly from there.
It's kind of a sort of a flawed plan, and the degree of opposition is kind of mounting, and we'll see if it holds. There's a group, I think we mentioned them once before, called Enviro.Aero, which is a website that looks at environmental issues and the aviation industry. And they're sort of kind of going crazy over this issue. Again, the concern being that how can the UK impose these kinds of taxes on others? Is it actually a legal kind of thing to do?
And I'm afraid that this may be the case of the UK flexing a little bit more muscles than it has. For a very long time, Heathrow has been the gateway between the East and the West. And with aircraft capabilities being what they are, and ranges stretching, and capacities getting smaller as the 787 comes out, Heathrow's role will diminish. And I'm a little concerned that the UK may be accelerating that with this. Maybe they're overplaying their hand, thinking they've got the rest of the world in a situation in the world airlines where they're going to have to pay this regardless, when in fact technology is kind of pushing it the other way to perhaps overfly Heathrow, or, as the article suggests, just connect to smaller airports in other countries, especially with the Channel.
Yeah, they can be kind of putting themselves out of competition.
I don't see personally how they think they can sell it on an environmental basis. They can. I don't see the linkage unless they're, I don't know, going to buy flotation devices for polar bears or something with the money. It's just a poor excuse to raise a fee on a beleaguered industry that, you know, just barely staying alive as it is.
Right. Yeah, agreed. And that's one of the major points the airline makes, is this really has no connection to the environment other than it reduces the number of travelers greatly as the ticket prices will raise. I'm certain that that wasn't the intentions of the UK government, so we'll see what comes out of this in the coming months. Moving on to our next story, this from Flight Global. U.S. airline labor flexes its muscles. Heartened by the presidential victory of Democrat Barack Obama, U.S. airline labor is flexing its muscle as it prepares to recoup its concessions of recent years. William Swellbar of the MIT Airline Program says, "Never before have we seen such a convergence of amendable dates, because so many of the present contracts were negotiated during bankruptcy, we may have many contracts coming up on a close period."
Well, this is essentially the airline employees who gave up a lot in previous labor contract negotiations, thinking that the time may be ripe to get some of that back, right?
Yeah, and I think it may be a flawed reasoning, but you know, traditionally Democratic administrations have been a little more friendly to labor. But as we've talked about several times before, Max, you know, this it all depends on the health of the airlines. You know, with the B word kind of sneaking back into some of the airlines' operations. Labor is not going to have any huge wins if the airlines are not making money. Now, of course, making money is kind of a subjective term in today's accounting world. But you know, the point remains is that, you know, the economic viability of the airlines must be at least adequate in order for labor to really see any wins.
Yeah, Kevin, do you get any sense for how the, you know, the airline flight crews are?
I know that the airline flight crews, at least on my airline, which was Delta, we're probably still smarting from the, I know I am because I lost half my retirement, but we're still smarting from the blow they took. I don't see, and I also know that they've had this fantasy over the past, 20, 30 plus years that I've been an Alpha member, that maybe I won't be after this, that if they could only elect the right liberal Democratic candidate, then he or she would just make all their troubles disappear with the flair, you know, with just signing his or her name on something. And of course, the Democrats always promise that because it's an AFL-CIO deal and they get lots of support. But I agree that unless the airlines start making money, I don't think they have a strong bargaining position. I don't think the government that remains to be seen. I don't know if the government can impose labor contracts or not. But if you look historically, we had the Clinton administration in for 8 years, and they were, I guess, conceivably a liberal Democrat administration, and they, in my view, weren't friendly to the airlines at all. They let lots of bad things happen to us as a labor union during that period of time. And with the economy the way it is, and Obama's already going to be really searching for money for whatever he wants to do. And if his MO is to please the masses, and suddenly Aunt Sadie and Grandma Flo can't get to the family reunion because those greedy airline pilots and airline workers want money, I just don't think it's going to happen.
I agree. And, you know, that's kind of the conundrum that we're looking at. And I think pleasing the masses is a good way to put that. Because which masses do you need to please? The airline labor or the customers? Because they're in direct competition with one another as it relates to ticket prices, you know, to a point. You know, an administration's role in a labor conflict, I suppose, ultimately comes down to whether or not to allow a strike. Now, granted, there's some other indirect pressures that are placed, you know, throughout the course of the negotiations, but ultimately, I believe that's, and correct me if I'm wrong, Kevin, but that's ultimately where the administration plays a role.
Yes, and I seem to remember, and again, I'm not an ALPA official, so, but, you know, I'll preface my comment with that, but I seem to remember in previous contracts at Delta, when we got to the point of having a strike vote and rattling our sabers, we were told by the powers that be that it wouldn't fly because it's just as soon as we went out on strike, there'd be a presidential order, and I forget exactly what the order was called, that would force us back to work while the contract was being negotiated further. So the threat of a strike wasn't that great a threat. And if you were talking a national strike, or a national labor movement, thing, I think that ship sailed about 25 or 30 years ago. I don't think pilots as a whole, like to think that they're unified, but when it comes to it, they generally aren't. And 5 years ago, I would have been the first to argue the opposite, but looking at it from my perspective now, I just don't see how they can base the argument on economics, and really that's what matters.
Well, I think the big item that's kind of pushing this news story along is the issue that's happening with labor at Southwest, and there is starting to be some strife with labor at Southwest. Now, I don't think what's going on at the mainline carriers, or we'll call them the post-bankruptcy carriers, really even applies to what's going on at Southwest. These are two entirely different situations. But that it's all kind of coming together maybe is prompting a news story or two. But, you know, to talk more about, you know, the post-bankruptcy issue, you know, a lot of these concessions in and out of bankruptcy, American, you know, never went into bankruptcy. Effectively, they were still able to reorganize just without going into it. But a lot of these concessions that were made by the labor groups were kind of made with the promise that you'll get it back when things are better. Well, I think it's a definition of things are better, and the definition is different with the union as it is with the airlines. So, and I think that's kind of the crux of the issue here. In that, you know, the labor says we gave, now it's time to get back, where the airlines are still struggling. Granted, with if it wasn't fuel prices, then it's now the economy and the drop in passenger traffic.
I think in my view that it's probably just the whole press release is probably just a big giant trial balloon, like trying to get Obama's attention, like, hey buddy, we supported you, and here's what we expect. But I think the people that really know what's going on probably don't expect quite as much as they said they want.
And as a trial balloon, it really can't hurt.
Yeah, sure, I would do it. You know, I'd send that message in a heartbeat.
Okay, moving on to our next story and back into the international segment. This from theage.com.au, Thai protesters seize second airport. Thailand's government is set to declare a state of emergency at Bangkok's two airports, according to cabinet ministers. Authorities shut down the Thai capital's second airport after it was overrun by anti-government protesters yesterday, cutting the city off from air traffic. Apparently, this is a political battle that's going on in Thailand. People want there is a group who want the prime minister to step down. Which, of course, he has refused.
The interesting thing to me about this is that, I mean, this is crippling the country. You know, the disruption to commerce, disruption to tourism, just the movement of goods and services, which centers around these airports, is just significantly crippled, and it's probably going to bring down the government. So the interesting thing to me, though, is that, you know, that just a bunch of people can, you know, overrun an airport and you know, wield that kind of power. I mean, I don't know what kind of protection airports in general have, but I suspect that when they look at terrorism and other kind of violent acts like that, they haven't thought about sort of just large numbers of people just walking in and taking over.
I think if you look up the word irony in an aviation dictionary, it would be people delaying airplanes instead of airplanes delaying people.
Yeah.
I'm assuming any huge mob could overrun a fence, you know, and I don't know if they're cluttering the runway. I probably wouldn't want to land on them or anything. I'd
sure.
Write all sorts of letters and go to hearings.
Now, with the events this last week in Mumbai, I think this has kind of made everybody on edge about the Bangkok situation as well, even though it is a very different situation. From what I was able to see on the news, it seems like this is more of a peaceful protest, I mean, as much as it can be. You know, there's no bloodshed, and I think it's kind of a sit-in, just kind of bringing everything to a standstill.
Some international crews are getting a dynamite Bangkok layover. They're getting like a week-long. You know, per diem, one for 3.5 credit time.
Yeah, no kidding.
Good deal.
Okay, moving on to the next story. This from IATA. Traffic decline continues, second month of global contraction. The International Air Transportation Association announced international air traffic for October, showing a second consecutive month of global decline. International passenger traffic declined by 1.3% compared to the same month in the previous year, a smaller decline than the 2.9% drop experienced in September. Just a breakdown of some of the regions in the world. The Asia-Pacific carriers, they represent 31% of global international traffic, saw passenger traffic decline by 6.1%. North American carriers only saw an international decline of 0.8%, which is only slight. You know, it is, and I, you know, my theory on that, Max, is that the domestic decline is so much greater that they're just pushing aircraft into the higher yield international flights, get better utilization on them, maybe not necessarily making as much money, or I think maybe it's just not losing as much. Let's see, Latin America and Middle Eastern airlines recorded 4.5% and 3.5% growth, and African carriers saw the largest decline, with international traffic dropping by 12.9%.
I'm just guessing Africa might be more of a political situation decline than an economic one. Is 0.8% even statistically significant?
Right, you wonder.
That's a good question.
Now, cargo for North America, though, is a different story. Right. According to the article there, for North American and European cargo carriers, they saw a decline of 7.6% last month and 5.4% the month prior. So there's a big drop in the carrier, in the cargo area.
Yeah, cargo's really being hit hard, which, you know, seems to be, you know, a direct result of the consumerist economy, as a lot of the on-demand products are carried across, specifically the Pacific, which saw an 11% decline in cargo traffic. Latin America saw an 11.4% decline, and Middle East, which is doing well, especially in cargo with Dubai, did see a 1% growth.
I think you're right about a lot of the airlines that are able to are moving a lot of their capacity into overseas operations because they get a little bit better money. You know, the hub and spoke system, I think, has been pretty much turned over to the regional carriers now, hasn't it, in terms of, you know, Louisville to Atlanta, those kind of flights.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. And I think, you know, kind of to my point earlier, that number in and out of North America, I think, is a little jaded in that, you know, you have carriers in the U.S. that are domestic. The majority of their operations are domestic. That is where they're getting hit the hardest, so they are compensating that with more international growth, whereas, say, European, Asia-Pacific carriers, all they do is international. So when they get hit, they have to take some out. There's no other markets to try out. Remember, this will eventually be skewed by Delta's recent announcement to launch 757s from every backwoods airport in the U.S. over to Europe. I think there were 15 flights that they were going to begin. And I think that just kind of illustrates what we're seeing in the U.S. with them moving maybe, it's a big maybe, towards some better yields. There's a lot of skepticism around that as well.
And the executives and the airlines that talked to me back when they used to talk to me were real excited about moving more into international, strangely enough, because it's more regulated. They have a better chance of getting their price than they do in a deregulated environment. And it's much harder for a startup to offer $50 tickets to Frankfurt, you know, Atlanta-Frankfurt, just because of the added problems of overseas travel. You know, the upstart airline, the new startup airlines, it's easier for them to enter the market domestically than it is internationally. And because of the international regulations, it's strange, but the airlines that love deregulation, or so they say, tend to gravitate back toward regulation when they want a steady paycheck.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I liked how the IATA took the opportunity at the end of this press release, though it's not directly related, to take another dig at the UK air passenger duty tax, saying that it's a major step in the wrong direction. What we need is, they say, common sense in taxation. So they just took the opportunity to kind of mention that at the end of the article.
I think it's the point we were trying to make in the 1760s.
Yeah.
I say we dump some tea in the harbor.
There you
go. That's right.
Apparently they didn't, get the point.
So. Okay, moving on to our last story, a little upbeat news. This out of China and the WashingtonPost.com. China's first homegrown jet makes trial flight. China's first fully homegrown commercial aircraft, the ARJ-21, successfully made its maiden flight on Friday, a key step in the country's ambitious aviation program. The flight was made from a local airport in northern Shanghai's Boshan district and went extremely well. The China News Service and other state media reported, for safety reasons, the aircraft was allowed to maintain a maximum height of about 3,000 feet. This airplane is, it's a 90-seater. It looks an awful lot, if I can remember, I'm not looking at a picture, looks an awful lot like the EMB-190.
Yeah, this is actually built with the tooling that McDonnell Douglas originally provided to the Chinese for a deal where they would license production of the MD-90. So the Chinese say that this has, it's all their design. But it does use that tooling, and when you look at a DC-9, you look at a picture of this aircraft, there are some definite visual similarities.
Certainly. Now, the ARJ currently has a total of 206 orders. This is all according to the Chinese government. The big item in here, and this has surprised me, deliveries of the jets costing only $27 million apiece are scheduled to begin within 18 months. So $27 million for a 90-seat jet. Compare that to, the Embraer 190 list price, which, granted, is subject to deals and, bulk rates and whatnot, is about $37.5 million.
It would certainly make it a competitive product, huh?
According to the AIAA, it was $35 million, and that was in 2001. So take that into account and do the conversions to 2008 dollars, and we're right up at that $37.5 million for something that this ARJ is at least claiming to be a direct competitor for.
How good is the intel out of China when their press is still controlled by the central government, right? So would we actually get bad news about a new aircraft when it first came out?
Very good point.
Not likely, right?
Very good point. So, some of the stats on the airplane has a maximum range of 2,300 miles and altitude of 39,000 feet. Didn't see any information on the speed of the aircraft, however. And to your point, Kevin, it seems like this may be an area where we see the aircraft not necessarily living up to its promise.
This aircraft does have a pretty healthy international content as well. We've talked in the past about content with the Air Force tanker, for example, and this has a lot of international content too. The engines are GE. I think they're CF-34. The avionics is Rockwell Collins. The fly-by-wire is Honeywell. So, like almost any aircraft these days of this size, the international content is very large. So, in the future, if we see the Chinese peddling this in the U.S. or in other Western countries, I'm sure we'll get into the buy American versus buy foreign arguments once again, but people should know that the content here is not so straightforward.
Well, maybe I'm just being an old cold warrior, you know, because it probably is exactly what they say. And it also occurred to me, how often would an American producer of an aircraft give you a bad story about a new product right away? So,
you know. Sure.
I'm sure everybody's PR people send it positively. So maybe it's a wonderful jet and we'll all enjoy flying it.
Okay, moving into our main topic, and again, we're talking with Kevin Garrison. He's an aviation writer, a humorist, and a retired airline captain. Kevin is also the author of The CEO of the Cockpit. You can find all of his information about his book, as well as the blog, which you've heard about here on Airplane Geeks before. That's the Hog Log blog. Find all of that at kevincreates.com. Kevin, thanks again for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me, even with all my opinions over the news. I really appreciate it.
Well, that's why we want you. It turns out it gets boring when it's just Max and I after a while, so we have to bring you guys in to kind of spice it up.
I find it hard to believe after listening to you guys.
He is a humorist, isn't he?
He is a humorist. Kevin, I'm very curious about your book. Can you kind of talk about how you came to write it? Is this a long time project, something you've wanted to do for a long time? Just kind of talk about how you came up with it and what went into creating it.
Yes, the book is, to make the long story even longer, the book, the title CEO of the Cockpit is a ripoff of my column on AvWeb, which is titled CEO of the Cockpit, which is a ripoff of a book written by P.J. O'Rourke. He wrote a book called The CEO of the Sofa. And it was a political book where a fictional character, kind of a curmudgeonly old, I'll say fart, would hold forth on the issues of the day. And I thought it was okay to steal his title because he actually stole it from, oh my goodness, it was a writer in the 1800s, and it'll come to me in a minute, but I don't have it right now.
This is like serial plagiarism.
Yeah, and the book was The Aristocrat at the Breakfast Table. Oh, Oliver Wendell Holmes. How could I forget Oliver Wendell Holmes? Not the judge, the writer. He was actually the most famous writer of the time back then. And, you know, after a third-handed ripoff, I went ahead and made a book out of it. Basically, the CEO is a conglomeration of all the airline captains I've ever flown with, including me. There's a lot of me in it. He's very opinionated and likes to hear the sound of his voice, so he does a lot of the talking in the columns, and some of them are funny, and some of them have made readers angry over the years. I've gotten my share of hate mail.
Are those the people that saw themselves?
No, basically those are people, and I'm probably going to insult some of your audience here, but those are people who had an image of what an airline pilot was and didn't ever think of it as a job and thought airline pilots never got tired or never got sick or never got angry and everything was la-di-da all day long and flying through blue skies and aren't you lucky to have a job and all that kind of stuff, which is true for a very large part of the job. But you fly a lot of Christmases and you fly when you're sick sometimes, even though people tell you you're not supposed to because you have to, you know, make the house payment. And, you know, as well as I do, that happens. And the times that I showed the harder side of the profession, I tried to show it honestly, but I also showed it satirically. And people's image of what the job is like, I think it hurt their feelings because I wasn't, the character wasn't grateful enough. I had a few emails of people that wanted, you know, I'm going to make sure you lose your job and that sort of stuff. And, normally,
wow.
you just write back and say, well, you know, I'm glad you're a fan. Thanks for writing, because I know that bugs them more than anything. But they were a minority. Most people seem to like it, and hopefully more people will like it now. And it's just a collection of those things, so people can have them all in one place. It's a little over 200, and actually a little over 300 pages. And I kind of like it, and I hope everybody else does too. And it's not... The negative part's very small. The positive part, I hope, is large, because I had a wonderful career, and I enjoyed it. And the characters I flew with, I tried to put in the book, and they're not necessarily what people might expect, but they're about as true as I could make them. So we'll see, and hopefully that'll be something that works out that people enjoy. It's available at kevincreates.com. I published it under a little production company I have called Mud Pony Productions. Since I own a horse farm with muddy ponies, I thought that might be a good name for a company. And if it's in the least successful, we'll expand it out and sell it through bigger booksellers like Barnes & Noble and your Amazon.coms and stuff like that. But for now, I'm just offering it to aviation people. It's not written for non-pilots. It's basically written for pilots. A lot of the terminology and stuff is pretty much a pilot-only thing. So I immediately cut my potential audience way down.
But you must have had a lot of really good material over the years.
Yeah, I did. I flew with a lot of really cool guys. I don't think I ever flew with anybody. Well, there are a few people I didn't enjoy, but even then I found a way to enjoy them. And everybody I flew with was smarter than me and more talented than me and had way more college degrees than me and had way more adventures than I've ever had. And I miss them greatly now because I don't get to lay over with them anymore. And but the guys that are doing the job, the guys and the girls that are doing the job, are just the finest kind. They're just the best people you'll ever meet, and they're not what you would expect. You know, for example, we don't, in the airline cockpits, we don't talk an awful lot about flying. We don't spend a lot of time talking about flying. It's I've flown with lawyers and doctors and oil explorers and just all kinds of people, and had all kinds of neat stuff happen over the years, and had a great career. It was cut a little short. I had the health problem that kind of threw me out, and then the bankruptcy kind of induced me to leave a few years early, but I enjoyed every moment of my airline career, and now I'm enjoying general aviation way more. That was my background. I was a line boy, actually, in Lakeland, Florida when I started, and I flew the first Aircoop flyby at the very first Sun and Fun. A lot of people probably still remember that, you know, and I don't know if they have pictures, but, you know, I got a hefty 3 or 4 degree nose-up attitude and went smoking by at about 80 knots, and I think I pretty much impressed everybody at that thing. I'm sure they still talk about it.
For those of our listeners who don't think that a pilot can produce any good literature, I'd just kind of like to read something here from your blog that just kind of grabbed my attention. This is from the Hog Log blog. In your one of your recent posts, Kevin, you said, "If flying back in the ancient 1970s wasn't all fun and games, for example, we all super freaked back when avgas hit 49 cents a gallon.
49 times. It was awful. And I remember back then I got a penny a gallon bonus in Lakeland. Actually, I probably ought to write another book maybe about that, but we had two FBOs in Lakeland, and some people may remember this. We had Lakeland Flying Service, and we had Roberts Flying Service. It was owned by the Roberts brothers, who were actually barnstormers in the 30s. And we were right alongside each other on the ramp, so we had heavy competition, and that extra penny a gallon, when the Philip Morris G2 would come in, we'd literally go out and fight over it. It got to the point where they had court orders restraining us from fighting over these jets when they would come in. And we actually had a golf cart that I got pushed along. They pushed me with their pickup truck at about 30 miles an hour one day, which led to some stuff. But, 49 cents a gallon. And I think, boy, I'm beginning to sound like an old guy, but I think the 150s back then rented for $10 an hour wet, because I know the instructors were $5, but I think dual was $15 an hour.
Kevin, how many different aircraft do you figure you've flown over the years?
In general aviation, I haven't really flown much of the new stuff. I've flown the Cirrus and all, but pretty much every general aviation production airplane, you know, Piper, Cessna, Mooney, Luscombe, Aranca, just about during my instructing career when I was in college and a little bit thereafter, we flew 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 different airplanes a week, sometimes more. So it's hard to say, but in the airline world, I was kind of I guess I couldn't hold a job because I went to a lot of schools, because I just couldn't believe, coming from a general aviation background, I could not believe they would pay me to get a type rating on stuff. I'm serious. I know that sounds really weird, and I know the airline guys listening to this are probably looking up at they're casting their eyes upward, because airline people hate going to school. And once I got there, I hated it. But I always looked forward to going until about 10 minutes into the first day. And then I go, oh, man, crap, I can't believe I did this to myself. But I did all three seats on the 727. I did the DC-8 engineer, DC-9 co-pilot and captain, MD-88 captain. See, I mentioned 727 captain, 767 co-pilot and captain, and I flew the 777 as a first officer for a couple of years. And I think that may be about it. But
do you have a favorite across all of those?
You know, the 777 was the best airplane in terms of systems and just everything behaving like a pilot would think it would. An airplane should behave. I mean, the school was the easiest school I ever went to because whenever a system would come up, it would be just intuitively just exactly what a pilot would want it to do. But I only flew it for a year or two, about a little bit less than 2 years. And the airplane, this sounds really weird, but the airplane I enjoyed the most was the MD-88. And a lot of airline pilots would disagree with me. But I grew up flying light twins in the Southeast. You know, I flew canceled checks and, you know, Piper Aztecs and Navajos and Barons and stuff like that. So it was just natural to fly through the Southeast in a twin-engine jet. And I think I flew the MD-88 as a captain more than any other airplane. And this is another weird thing. I enjoyed doing landings and approaches. And I got international, I would get really bored on an 8 or 9 hour flight. So, and I loved the 727. I can't think of an airplane I didn't like, but I think my favorite would be the MD-88. And probably following that would be the 727 because I was younger when I flew engineer and co-pilot on that. And it was back during the so-called good old days of airline flying, and I had more fun than a human being should be allowed to have.
Well, Kevin, I don't know how familiar you are with the podcast, but we like to make our guests suffer by going through a little something we call word associations.
Oh, awesome. I know all about words. I'm a professional.
Yeah, you are. You're a professional with words.
Okay, I shout out the first obscene word I can think of when you give me the word, right?
Absolutely. And it's great because I have a little bleep that I can put in post-edit, too. So.
Oh, darn. Okay.
So, Kevin, what do you think of when I say Southwest Airlines?
Oh, my gosh. Well, they're making money. I'll give them that. I know that they made a lot of money when they had fuel hedges in place, and now the way I understand it, their fuel hedges aren't necessarily in place the way they used to be. So I think they're about to rejoin the ranks of the rest of the great unwashed in the airline world, but I wish them all the best. I know they're good guys. But the only possible thing I could say negative about them as a pilot is I think they still, and this is probably one of the reasons they still make money, they only fly 737s. As an airline pilot, that would bug me because, like I said before, I like flying different airplanes.
Right. Good.
Okay, my first word, Kevin, or I should say my first set of words, stick and rudder.
Oh, I can't pronounce that guy's last name. Was it Leach? This is terrible because he could probably pronounce my last name. But didn't he recently pass away, the author of that book? Yeah, I remember that. I picked that book up a few months ago, and I don't know. Oh, I know why. I was at a used bookstore because I'm really, even though I expect my readers to buy my book at full retail price, I hardly ever do. And I looked at it, and I remembered thinking, "Wow, this is a really great aviation classic and all that." And I kind of looked at it, and I thought, "Well, yeah, but maybe I don't know. It's nice. I think all new pilots ought to read it. I know I did when I was younger, and thoroughly enjoyed it."
This is the book by Wolfgang Languishy or something like that? Or
I'm probably going to go to aviation hell for at least a couple of weeks just because I couldn't, you know.
With as much time as you spent in Atlanta, you've already been to aviation hell.
Yeah,
I've been to CRM training dozens of times.
Outstanding.
I spent my time in hell. But, great book. I'm sure the movie will be boffo, but in terms of just using stick and rudder, I've recently started using those again. So nowadays, my airplane is I fly a Champ quite a bit, and it both has a stick and a rudder, and you have to use both frequently. So.
Great. Okay. Next, I have slot auctions.
Stock options.
Slot auctions.
Slot. SLOT.
Yes.
See, I'm going deaf. I flew the 727 for years.
Those JTAs were loud.
I don't even know if I have an opinion on that. That's, you know, to use Obama's phrase, that's above my pay grade.
Okay, my next word, or phrase rather, The good old days.
I hope he doesn't have to adjust your volume. How many times have you guys heard that? Oh my God!
Yeah.
When I call it during my brown hair days. Back when I was in, my hair is just a beautiful shade of gray now. But back during my brown hair days, when I was an engineer, like in the late 70s, early 80s, the good old days were the mid 60s, and you'd hear these captains just, you know, tell you they only had to be a co-pilot for, I don't know, 20 or 30 minutes, and then they were made captain, and how the good old days were, and the booze and the sex and everything else was flowing freely and all that. And I find myself now when people, I think I referred to it once already in this podcast about, oh, the so-called good old days. And I don't know, what do you guys think? Do you think it's a function of youth versus age or experience versus, because I'm sure, I'm completely 100% sure the airline pilots starting today are just having a great time, you know? I'm sure the job is still fun for some people. I know it got to be less fun near the end for me, but maybe it was just because I was getting to be an old guy.
You know, especially for pilots, the regulated era seems to at least have been a little bit more pilot friendly than the deregulated environment that we find ourselves in now.
I agree. I mean, I know when I started, I think deregulation, it's probably the reason I started was because deregulation had just kind of gotten fired up. But there are also things that people, boy, I sound like I'm a big curmudgeon again. Maybe I am the CEO of the cockpit. But there were a lot of bad associated with the fact that captains were kings. You know, that back during the so-called good old days, captains did what captains did, and hearts were brave, and, you know, women were women, and men were men, and blah, blah, blah. But they were allowed to make a lot of mistakes, too, and we flew through a lot of really crappy weather that people don't fly through today because we have better technology and better training. You know, back in the so-called good old days, nobody had radar training. We had no satellite imagery. We had no, you know, so we tended to fly through a lot of thunderstorms that we didn't have to. And a checklist was optional back then when I started. I mean, officially it wasn't, but if a lot of times when I was a new hire engineer, I would start a checklist and be told to shut up, that we know what we're doing. That never happens now. You know, guys tend to toe the line. So I don't know. I know I look back on my career, and I think the early half of it, in terms of just having fun, was better. But, you know, I survived and I didn't kill anybody, so maybe the changes were good.
All right, my last one is, and you actually just start to touch on it a little bit a few minutes ago, is youth in aviation.
Yeah. Boy, that's a long subject. In the good old days, you know, to coin a phrase, when I started at Lakeland, the reason I started as a line boy at Lakeland was because I was there every day. And they finally got around to offering me a job, because I literally would bicycle the 5 or 6 miles out to the airport and sit there in airplanes all day. I would, if the airplane was unlocked, I'd sit in it when I was 10, 11, 12 years old, you know, and pack a lunch. My mom would pack me a lunch, and I'd spend all day at the airport, and occasionally somebody would give me a ride, and that was just really cool, you know, and nobody had amber alerts or worried about me, you know. And now, of course, that's gone. Kids can't just go to the airport and hang around airplanes. So, I don't know. And I'm not sure programs, I'm sure Young Eagles is a wonderful program, but I'm not sure that can replace the actual airport bum that later becomes a pilot. I've always had strong opinions about aviation schools, which I'll try to tone down, but I don't see the economics in spending almost $100,000 to get a $20,000 a year job. But I know it gets bigger as time goes on. But maybe because I went through it this way, I think I was, I don't know if I was better prepared, but I felt better prepared with the 3,500 hours I had when the airlines hired me, because I'd been upside down a few times. I'd been through some bad weather. I'd been, you know, it wasn't because I went through a school. I just had the experience. So I really don't know. Maybe it's better if they go to a college and get the experience. But I do know, I've talked to Jim Bass, the CEO of Piper, a couple times about this, and their entry-level age for an airplane buyer is 50 years old right now.
Okay, the last word then, Kevin. Airplane geeks.
I thought about that. That's funny that you mentioned that, because I thought, you know, I'm sure you guys will agree with me, geek is a much nicer word than a nerd, right?
Anymore? I mean, that those are the richest people in the world.
Yeah, I know that's true, but I know from watching a couple movies that athletes and fraternity brothers don't like them.
Yeah. But in the end, we
they get revenge. Yeah. You know, don't get me wrong.
That's right.
They go to paradise or whatever that last one was. But yeah, I've always envied airplane geeks because aren't they the guys that, you know, not only are they really into it as I have been, but they can like actually work on airplanes and stuff. And I've always had a policy that I would never fly anything that I built. And my other policy is I would never fly an airplane that was smaller than me. So that's kept me out of the ultralight game. But, you know, More power to them. You know, I think that's what makes it, now I sound like a politician, but I really truly believe this. I think that's one of the things that makes America so great. And that's why I kind of look down my nose at the Chinese, which is probably totally politically incorrect. But, you know, where else in the world can you build your own airplane in your basement just for grins?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Take that sucker out, fire it up, and go fly. You think you could do that in central, you know, in Europe or in most of the countries, even in Africa, you probably couldn't do that. The freedom to say, you know what, I think I'm going to build myself an airplane.
Right, right.
Or maybe I'll just make stuff up, or you know, I'll just build something I just think of, and we'll call it experimental, and I'll fly it. I know the aviation world is much more restrictive than it was when I started flying. But how can the terrorists win when they can't even build? I mean, they can steal an airplane, you know, but can they build one? I don't think so. You know,
no.
But can they conceive of a world where just Joe Average Six Pack is allowed? It's not allowed, but has the freedom to just decide, you know what, I'm going to build a subsonic home-built airplane in my garage because, you know why, what the hell, I think it'll be fun, you know, because I think it's maybe the only place in the world that you can still do that.
Kevin, again, thank you very much. For all the listeners, please make sure to check out his website and his book. The book is The CEO of the Cockpit. You can find more about that at kevincreates.com. We'll have a link to it on our website and the show notes. Kevin, thank you.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again to Kevin Garrison, the author of The CEO of the Cockpit. Now, Max has his pick of the week.
Yeah, this week, the website that I've chosen is, if I can get this right, is Le Cirque Volant, which is Flying Circus, if you're not a French speaker. And this is a magazine that's available on the net in PDF form, and it has the subtitle The Aviation Photographer's Journal. And it contains really a series of articles and accompanying photographs. Oftentimes they have technical information about the images. Sometimes the content is original and sometimes it's reprinted from elsewhere. But in total, it's typically an impressive collection of aviation pictures. And you can find that at harryblack.files.wordpress.com. The most recent issue came out November 5th and it includes a piece on aircraft carrier operations, flying cross-country in a 1929 biplane, some coverage of a North American Harvard event, a reprint of Tracing the Human Footprint from National Geographic, and a nice collection of some other in-flight photos. But I was sort of pleasantly surprised to find that the feature piece is on our friend Francois Brevaux, who sent us listener mail last week that Court read, and also he was a pick of the week back in episode 17 with the Skylens Aviation site. So he's got a prominent position in the latest issue, and you can see a lot of his excellent photography if you give it a look.
We do have a voicemail. This from Dan Webb.
Hey, Max. Hey, Court. It's Dan Webb calling in. Just wanted to share a couple comments about what I think was the biggest story of the week, which was Southwest declaring its intention to acquire ATA's 14 slots of LaGuardia for 7 departures and 7 arrivals. And I think a lot of the speculation the past few days has been about where exactly are they going to serve, what cities they're going to serve from LaGuardia. And I'm agreeing with a lot of the people out there. I think almost all the service is going to be to Midway. I think it's going to be a strategy similar to Minneapolis. I think Southwest would be very careful. Obviously, they're probably concerned about the busy airspace around New York. They're probably concerned about delays. Also, with AirTran and JetBlue, with their heavy presence in New York, there's probably not as much opportunity to get some market share in the Florida market. So I think there's going to go into Midway and provide some connections. But I also think Nashville is a good option for some Western connections. But one theory I thought of today was maybe, let's say, Southwest serves just Midway. Why not make maybe the first three morning flights, make them one stops and go to Phoenix and Vegas and LA or any other Western city for that matter. And that way you can get some transcon traffic and could serve as a clever way to get around LaGuardia's perimeter rule. So I was just wondering what you guys thought about the whole thing and specifically my theory. So anyway, happy Thanksgiving, guys, and hope to talk to you soon. Bye.
I actually got some listener email also. This was from Mark, who goes by Bulldog3 on mytransponder.com, which is where he sent me a message. And he just said simply that he wanted to thank us for the Airplane Geeks podcast. He enjoys listening every week. I guess he works with a regional airline, and he enjoys all the insight that comes from the podcast. And he says that we shouldn't hesitate if he can contribute in any way to the podcast. And there's a few ways you could contribute to the podcast. Probably the main one is to tell all your friends.
Yes, absolutely. Tell all your friends, or you could send us an email, or you could sign up for the newsletter, which isn't necessarily a contribution to us, although we appreciate it, but it is something that we can contribute to you by including the show notes as well as any of the news articles that made news throughout the week, but we didn't have time to cover on the podcast. You can find that newsletter at airplanegeeks.com. If you would prefer to send us an email, we'll read it on the podcast. You can send it to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll get it read. I do have one more message. This actually came through a different medium. It was a forum message that was sent to me, this from Mikhail. He says he loves the podcast to the max, which I think max is a compliment to you. Says he always looks forward to it every week, and while waiting, I would actually listen to the podcast I downloaded to my PSP over and over.
Did you say dilated?
Downloaded.
Okay.
I may have. I'm getting over a cold. I'm actually smack dab in the middle of it. So, from henceforth on the Airplane Geeks podcast, when you hear me ask you to dilate something, I would like you to download something.
Got it.
Synonymous. So thanks, Mikhail. He does say, you know, I've noticed you only cover the American airline industry. It would be nice to hear some airline news from Europe and Asia, too. I hope this podcast was a little bit better, this episode. We did get into some of the issues going on in the UK and Asia as well. That, I have to admit, is dumb luck. Max came up with some good stories. So as much as I'd like to say we responded to one of our listeners' feedbacks, which we do, that one was dumb luck. But it is something that we've been trying to move more into and learn a little bit more about the international side as well. So we appreciate that feedback. Again, if you'd like to send us an email, it's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. You can also leave a comment on the blog. That's at airplanegeeks.com. Sign up for the newsletter there as well. Don't forget that if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, we'll get it played on the podcast. You can call 812-757-4252 and leave a message. You can also record yourself on MP3. It tends to be a much better quality, and send it to us via email. We do appreciate that. And as always, and as Max had mentioned earlier, the best way that you can support us is by telling your friends and your enemies.
Anybody that you know.
Anybody. Just tell them. So we do appreciate that. So other than that, Max, I think we've covered everything we wanted to cover on episode 25. A big thanks to Kevin Garrison for spending some time with us. And to you as well, Max, for keeping me on track once again.
Well, thank you. I think that's a wrap.
I think it is. Join us next week as we talk airplanes and geekdom on episode 26 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We'll see you guys.
Bye, everybody.